This is On the Shoulders of Giants podcast with me, Millard Roper, and my friend, Mike Fawcett.
Hello.
Hello, Millard Roper.
Hello, Mike Fawcett. So you asked to come on again.
Yes.
With a specific topic in mind.
Yes. So to have a little preface of this, I have a nephew. His name is Lucas. And all he wants to do is play Minecraft.
Yes.
Because he's a 8-year-old boy.
Sure.
And I play with him because it's something I'm into. And at one point, something incredible happened for him. And he exclaimed, "Oh my God, oh my God." And I'm like, and sitting there thinking, this got me on this train of thought. How does he conceptualize God? Like, what is it? What is it, like, what does that mean to him? Because he says that, he said that as kind of like an exclamation, but for me, I think, does he know this experience of God? And I wonder how, as a yoga teacher, how as this teacher figure to him, as his uncle, it's like, how would you explain God to someone with no conception of it?
Did you ask him?
No, I didn't ask him.
How old is he again?
He's 8.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I've asked Seamus, definitely. Mm-hmm. I've been like, hey, man, what do you think of God?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that word, what does that word mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
Seamus is savvy in his, he knows me. He's heard me say and give lectures enough to know the right answer to give, but mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that he's experienced
right.
his own connection
mm-hmm.
to a divine source yet.
Mm-hmm.
But so did you? You didn't even approach it, but you
no.
just thought, how do you explain God
how would
to a
you,
child?
Yeah, and like I don't want to put in my own ideas into his head. I want to. Because he's 8, he's still learning. I don't know if he's conceptualized that sort of pathway. And I want to let him have this experience on his own. But if I wonder if he asked me that question, how would I respond necessarily?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Bless you.
So, basically, like, what if, like, hypothetically,
mm-hmm.
he asks you, hey, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
What is God?
Mm.
What would you say to him?
I'd probably say, ask your parents.
Yeah.
But put to the test, it's, I don't know. I would preface it by saying this is my belief of what God is, because I feel like it's something on your own journey you have to find on your own. For me, it's this presence that exists in all things. It's this ethereal entity that that permeates different people and different creatures and different space. It's not something that we as limited human beings are meant to understand in a lot of ways.
Right.
But it's like, I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but it has this clockwork effect. It's always there, and it kind of knows what's there, and it exists separate to our own tangible existence.
Were you there when I read that that woman's definition of God at Kirtan?
I don't think so.
This woman wrote a book. The name of the book was Holy Envy. And let me just see what her name was. Because her name's escaping me. Barbara Brown Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And she was some kind of Catholic holy person. I think she was a Presbyterian or something.
Okay.
I forget which branch of the faith she was a part of, but she was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And she ended up writing a book called Holy Envy. And she started teaching a class on divinity, on religions of other faiths
mm-hmm.
at college. So she had to be somewhat somewhat scholastic, academic in her viewpoint. It wasn't as faith-based as it was, you know, structured. And their thing was they would go to, they went to, it was like old field trips. They went to a mosque. They went to a Hindu temple. They went to a Buddhist temple. They went to different faiths of Catholicism or Christianity. They went to a synagogue, and they did all these things, and she got what she called holy envy. And, you know, she was kind of like envious of these other people's connection to their source of divinity. Mm-hmm. But what she realized in the mix was there was a common thread between them, which was this overwhelming sense of being loved. Mm-hmm. And kind of like nurtured. And she gave this beautiful definition of God. And I'm going to find it and I'm going to read it. But you weren't there that day that I read it?
I don't believe so. I'm sure at some point I've heard allusions to it, if not the whole thing. Oh, man.
Yeah. She was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR, and I heard her and I was like blown away. I was driving my car and I was listening to NPR, and I just stopped the car and I started to like just listen.
Yeah.
And I don't do that very often, and I was so taken back by what she said. So I have her transcript pulled up here from when she was on there. But I think this would be a very interesting thing to say to a child, even this, because I think her definition is so fleshed out. So she said, "When I use the word God, I'm aware I'm using a code word, and that everyone who hears the word, and probably everyone who uses it, imagines something different. Imagines a different posture in front of that being, that presence. I suppose my own image, my own idea of God, as imperfect and as evolving as it is, right now would be the glue that hooks everything together, the consciousness that moves between all living things." I mean, I'm going to read on, but that alone, boom.
Yeah.
You know, like drop that. Like, she says, "My own idea of God, as imperfect and evolving as it is, right now would be the glue that hooks everything together, the consciousness that moves between all living beings."
Wow. Yeah.
Perfect, right?
That's all you need.
I need to sell that to Shane. So I think that would be a great starting place. Let me read on, just because she goes into it a little deeper. "When I use the word God, I do not envision a large person with two arms, two legs, a nose, and two eyes. I envision instead some presence so beyond my being, a presence that both knows the stars by name and knows me by name as well, that is not here to be useful to me, that is not here to give me things as much as to ask to give myself away for love." I mean, that's like a proper definition of bhakti.
Yes.
Like,
absolutely.
Like
that's
prop,
like right out of the Bhagavad Gita almost.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, I'm like, let me go back to this. This is good. "I, of course, get a great deal of what I mean by God from the tradition in which I stand, the Christian tradition, the Hebrew Bible, and the New Testament. But when I say I believe in God, I mean I trust. I trust in the goodness of life, of being. I trust that beyond all reason. I trust that with my life. And that's what I mean by God." I think that's so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think you would say something like that? Maybe just the first
probably
part,
not
right?
as eloquently yeah, as right? the way she framed it. But yeah, I would probably say something like that.
The consciousness yeah. that moves between yes. all living beings.
Do you think that exists in non-living beings as well?
God?
Yeah.
So this table?
Yeah,
for example. Does God exist in this table? Well...
Well, maybe,
according to the Gita,
yeah.
that there is, like, everything is a manifestation of God, mm-hmm. even, and it's the difference between Prakriti and Purusha.
Right.
So one has, like, animated spirit, and mm-hmm. one is just matter, right. like, denser matter. Now, we have within our own self, we are both Prakriti, we are both mm-hmm. a material thing, because once our soul is gone, there is still a... We're just
the
like this table.
And the flesh don't, yeah. Right? Don't have, I mean, the table is made from wood.
Right.
It used to be a tree.
So, in a way, we are animated Prakriti.
Mm. That's a great name for a band.
That's true, Mike. That's a good one. Animated Prakriti. And that's where I think you can have a bit of a nuanced understanding that yes, this is an extension of divinity, because if divinity created all this, then this is part
this
of
is
that
created by divinity. Yeah,
yeah, and so are we. Mm. We're just kind of like a level up.
Mm. I think that's something that I personally have a tendency to forget, but it's also something that I try to remind myself of too. For example, we do the sunset kirtans, and you see the sunset, and it's this beautiful thing, and it's hard to think of anything but God in this space. But at the same time, I'm looking up at the sky, and I see this airplane go by, and I think, well, there's something beautiful about that as well, because here's this vehicle that years and years before nobody would have ever thought exists, and it is carrying like 60 some odd people on their own journeys. They're watching the sunset from this thing, and is that not this amazing creation as well? It's like that comes from God, and here we are just sitting at the beach. It's like, oh, it's an airplane.
Yeah.
And that goes back to my nephew as well, because he used to look at this airplane as this our house that I live in is in a flight path, and he would just like sit outside, just watch the planes go by. It's this magnificent thing, and like I see that, and you know, some days I'll think it's like, wow, this is an amazing thing, and then there are other days like, oh, what's that noise outside? It's kind of annoying.
Right. I mean, in one way, like all the machinery that we have
yeah.
is an extension of us.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of the day, we are the animated piece that makes the machines move.
Yeah.
So it's almost exhilarating with machines, because you can have a problem with your own body, mm-hmm. like, and it's not performing the way you want it to perform, but you can get in a machine and create a machine that performs the right way. And you can usually fix the machine, you know, if it breaks or whatever, or find a way to fix it. And our own machine, sometimes we're more knowledgeable about our machines and taking care of them than we are about our own body. I mean, how many people, they get their oil changed once every few thousand miles,
right.
but they go and they eat sugary food that's filled with... I mean, not to sound dramatic, but like poison.
Yeah.
Like sugar is like literally poison yes. for our body.
Yeah.
It serves no purpose other than it tastes really yummy.
Mm-hmm.
So like, in a way, like you can look at people and you can see they take care of their car better than they take care of their own mm-hmm. machine, their body. I think that's an odd dichotomy that we have.
How do you think we got to that point? Like, that we don't have this tendency to take care of ourselves as well as we should. Like, we almost... There's this self-destructive instinct that we almost have, that sometimes we just gear towards that option instead of taking the option that is better for ourselves.
That's a good question. Like, why are we defaulted to...
Yeah.
To, like, self-destruction? And,
yeah.
I mean, jiu-jitsu has taught me so much in life. And I can use the analogy so readily because I've spent almost 20 years on the mats and really looking to understand that you come away with some philosophy.
Right.
In that, you'll find that a lot of what we do in jiu-jitsu is counterintuitive, meaning if I put my legs around you and let's say you're on your knees and I put my legs around your waist, right? I was on my back. It's a position called the guard. Mm-hmm. My legs are wrapped around your waist. I'm on my back. Instinct would tell the person that's on the knees that has the legs wrapped around them to put the hands on the floor and, like, get stable. Mm-hmm. Like, use your hands there. But that's exactly what the person who has the legs wrapped around your waist wants you to do, because then all of a sudden you open up all these things for submission. Right. So it's a way of unlearning mm-hmm. your natural tendency. So I don't think our natural tendency is usually the right one, which is yeah. so odd, right? Because yeah. you would think we would be programmed to make the right choice, mm-hmm. but in a way it's almost like we're programmed to make the wrong choice.
Hmm.
Have you ever seen Million Dollar Baby?
I don't think so.
The boxing movie with Morgan Freeman and Clint Eastwood.
I don't think so.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's worth a watch.
Okay.
And the opening scene is Morgan Freeman with his, you know, silky voice, and he's all smooth and chill. And you see a woman shadow boxing. I think it's a woman. She's shadow boxing, and it's just the shadow of her silhouette. And he's describing how everything in boxing is backwards, mm. how it's counter, exactly what I just said. Yeah. It's counterintuitive. To move forward in boxing, let's say you have your right leg forward and your right hand forward. To shuffle, to move forward in boxing, you would step with the right foot first. Mm-hmm. And then the left foot will catch up. But if we're walking in Stop and Shop, we would walk left, right, right left, right, left, right. Hmm. We would alternate. So you, and to move left, you shuffle to the side. So it's an opposite of what you would normally do. And I don't know why that is. Well, why we're set up that way. Okay. It's a frustrating thing. But once I made peace with the fact that my mind and my body are not always necessarily looking to help me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay. Okay. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I still make the wrong choice, 100%. Mm-hmm. But at least I'm aware of that right. I shouldn't rely... These aren't my teammates.
That's the interesting thing for me, is because I know I have enough awareness to know that I'm not always making the right decision for myself. I'll try to start the sentence over. I'm at a point in my life where I've developed enough awareness that I know that sometimes I will be geared towards the wrong decision. But even having that awareness, sometimes I still will take that incorrect response.
You'll take the wrong decision.
I'll take the wrong decision. Even knowing, like, and sometimes it's unconscious, but sometimes it's like, I know this, what I'm doing right now, it's the wrong thing to do. And usually what I'll do in that instinct is
that instinct will have me do nothing. I'll let it just sort of play out and let nature take its course. But sometimes I will actively take the wrong choice.
On purpose.
On purpose. And I don't know.
Why would that be?
I don't know.
So, give me an example.
I'm trying to think of a good one.
Food might be
a good one. Food is a safe one. Yeah, food is a safe one. You know, it's like there's a jar of M&Ms that sits in my house, and it's a good one. And I will go for the M&Ms, and I'm like, I don't really need these, but I'll just pop a handful. And the first handful, I'm like, okay, that's fine. And then I'll go for another handful. And then the next thing I know, the jar will be half empty.
So this is the concept of free will, is that we're talking about. So our free will to make that choice of, do I go for the M&Ms or not? Now, are you the only one living there?
No, not the only one living there.
So who buys the M&Ms?
My mother does. Okay.
So, does she buy them for her or you?
She buys them for me, I think.
All right. Good to know. So, it would be a bold move to go, Ma,
just don't buy the M&Ms.
Stop buying anymore. The M&Ms, yeah. Please. No candy.
Yeah.
Because she'll go and buy Reese's or something like that.
Well, Reese's would be worse.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that would be the bold move. That's a little easier than
just
having
not,
them.
Yeah.
Oh, well, just have passing, one.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can handle that. I would have to cut it out completely.
There's some things that I know, like pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people sometimes will tease me and be like, hey, just have one slice of pizza. What's the big deal?
Mm.
Well, the big deal is I'm going to have 6 slices of pizza.
Right.
I'm not going to have 1 slice of pizza. And so then I need to make a choice. Either I cut it out completely or I kind of like...
Learn the discipline to mitigate.
Well, no, I haven't learned that discipline. I just really get after it and devour the pizza. So I know that, okay, no pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Now... I mean, that could be a form of an eating disorder, I guess. But, I mean, and that's where eating disorders get tricky for people, I think, is because an alcoholic can say, no more food. I'm sorry. An alcoholic can say, I'm not going to go to bars.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be around my old friends who get hammered. And I'm just not going to buy liquor anymore. No more liquor.
Mm-hmm.
Done. Somebody who has an issue with eating, they have their issue. They can't say no more food.
Right.
You need food. So you need to come up with some type of structure and be disciplined around your food. So for me, that means no pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've tried the vegan, gluten-free. It's not the same. It's like, nice try,
you know?
And I'm willing to partake occasionally in that, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
But you have that free will with the M&Ms to clearly say, no more M&Ms.
Okay.
Do you think you're going to do that?
I might. I don't know if she'll listen, and I don't know if, like, no more M&Ms will last for a little while, and then they'll come back into my life.
See, that's harder too, because let's change the scenario a little bit. Let's say mom buys the M&Ms for her.
Wow. Yeah.
Now that's a harder thing, right?
Because
because it's hers, and you need to discipline yourself.
Right.
To not go buy the M&Ms.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I realized is for myself is, I've had moments through my life. I'm 41 now. So I've had these moments where I've rectified things. I've rectified issues with diet, you know, things, other aspects. And I think with time, and this is where like judging other people gets harsh, because with time, people can change.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally change something about them.
Yeah, physiologically.
Physiologically, yeah. Right. But you need enough time and the right motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So given the, I was listening to this podcast yesterday, so great. Given the right time and enough motivation, you can.
Right.
You can. But do we have enough time?
It's finding the time and finding the right motivation.
Right. So what would be the motivation to stop eating the M&Ms? You got to find that.
Yeah.
I mean, not that that's the worst
thing. Right,
right.
Yeah.
The M&Ms are five M&Ms.
The M&Ms are an analogy for something else, I'm sure.
Right. I mean, you could put anything in there.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing with yoga. Yoga is trying to... We're learning to control our senses, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to fail over and over and get to try again.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we figure it out this time around. Maybe it's next time around.
Maybe it's next time. So let me ask, this is kind of getting back to the original topic at hand. Do you remember growing up, like your first interaction with this, or what's your story behind learning with the relationship with God, your personal relationship?
I would say my personal relationship around God has to do with my seizure disorder. And I would think it's hard to know God without some form of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm just speaking from like my own personal... I don't think I would come to know my connection to divinity if I didn't have that seizure disorder, if it didn't, and it still does, affect me in a powerful way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, from a young age, that did that, because I had to turn to something, because the medicine wasn't helping,
right. And
the doctors weren't helping. And I was left with my own suffering,
mm-hmm.
and trying to find a way out, and seeking. So I think that brought me into that connection.
Mm.
And that brought me to it. Was that your question?
That was my question.
Oh, yeah.
And then the follow-up question would be, like, how has your relationship with God changed since then? Since you were young, yeah.
It's amazing. It's the same and it's totally different. It's the same and it's totally different. Because while when I grew up, it was a Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
version of God, in the Bhakti tradition is that God loves you no matter what. And God's always right beside you. God's always looking out for you. God's your best friend. That was revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
To think of God as my best friend.
Yeah.
And not like, yeah, of course, you know. But no, like, in the Bhakti tradition, that's a definite way that you can look at divinity. And that was very enticing, because... the more I examined myself, the more I saw myself as so flawed.
Mm-hmm.
So in the tradition that I grew up with, I kind of felt I wasn't worthy of that connection, because I was like pretty messed up.
Yeah.
Like just in the way I can change my mind all the time, in the way that I'm kind of at the mercy of some of my senses just driving me
towards to eat the M&Ms.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
kind of tie these conversations right, together.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's it, you know? And I couldn't follow all their rules, and nor did I agree with a lot of what their rules were, but kind of the baseline of bhakti, the pillar that it rests on, is that God's your best friend.
Hmm.
or even take it a step further, God's a small child.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to serve. That's number one, more than anything else.
Yeah.
Is that God's a small child, and how can you help this small child? How can you serve this small child? It's like, that to me was way, way different. So that's the part that's way different. The part that's the same is the general feeling I get when I look to create that connection. That's the same feeling. It's the same God.
Mm.
So in that way, it's the same. And in the other way, it kind of makes me feel loved and accepted.
Right.
It's kind of like if somebody goes, hey, I love you unconditionally. And I think that's an interesting word that people throw around, unconditional love, because I feel like most of the love that we experience is conditional love.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't hit me. Don't cheat on me. Don't yell at me. Don't be mean to me. Be nice to me. Take out the garbage.
Right.
You have to do this. Yeah, a checklist. And I'm guilty of that just as much as other people are guilty of it. This is my criteria for romantic love.
Right.
And you must check, you must meet the criteria.
Yeah, get a couple check boxes in, and then you're up for evaluation.
And then you're up for evaluation. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Totally, you're up for evaluation. Next, or somebody does it to you, and then you get heartbroken, and they point out some things that you're maybe not so great at. And you're not checking off, you're not meeting their checks.
Mm-hmm.
So that conditional love, like, what if somebody was like, actually got to know you, and then was actually like, no, I love you unconditionally. Like,
I think it's a little too heavy.
It's super
heavy. For our mortal selves.
Totally.
Not only do I think we're not necessarily capable of it, but I don't think we really have to be for each other, I think. I don't think we have to love unconditionally.
Gauravani told me this great thing. He said that people look to each other to create and to receive this feeling of love.
Mm-hmm.
And they give this feeling of love, and they expect it in return.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like it's the wrong vessel. Meaning, let's say that I have a cup, and it's a paper cup. It's a thin paper cup. And I have molten lava, and I pour this lava into this cup. Mm-hmm. It's gonna melt the cup. It's thin paper, right? And then I have this crazy type of steel that doesn't melt with lava, right? I have this crazy vessel that can hold lava. So what we do is we take our love and we put it into another person, and then we melt right through them because we're taking what should be only God can really hold, and we're putting it in the wrong vessel, meaning another person, and relying on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think once we realize, oh wait, I have these conditions, I guess, and I can kind of expect them, you know, or I don't know. I'm still working that one out.
It's finding the right cup for your liquid, fluid, or and vice versa.
Yeah.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean that's heavy stuff.
Yeah.
I think we could stop it there.
We could stop there.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you,
Miller. This was fun. I enjoyed this.
This was good. It's always fun.
Always.